Okay. So the subject of my lectures will be matrix theory, of the mathematical aspects of matrix theory. And let me just say a few words about what this kind of entails. First of all, I think at this moment, matrix theory is the most serious candidate for a proposal of what non-perturbative string theory is. So one thing is that you definitely in string theory want to extend beyond perturbation theory or in mathematical terms, and extend beyond loop spaces and Riemann surfaces. And that's something that, so it's non-perturbative string theory. And one of the things I will actually, first thing I will do is to see how the formalism leads to the perturbative strings that we more or less know. Then, actually, from a mathematical perspective, the theory of matrix theory is actually nothing but D-brains. So I'll actually basically be talking about the same mathematical objects as Greg Moore was talking, but I actually won't kind of use much of the way he starts basically from the point of view of string theory. I will not. So I will actually have a little bit more of an intrinsic discussion, but so the mathematical objects are very much the same. There is an aspect to it which actually is perhaps not that familiar to mathematicians, which is the fact that the quantization you do is in a so-called light cone quantization, which roughly means that the time direction is chosen to be a null direction, which is slightly uncommon. So that's something we have to discuss. I actually will not do this today, but tomorrow. Then, right from the start, somehow non-commutative geometry is built in. And I think that's very beautiful. Somehow, string theory seems to gobble up all of mathematics, and now non-commutative geometry is also part of it. And finally, and that's also something we want take some time to get used to, is that it's describing string theory, but it's describing string theory in a second quantized language. So, and that will actually be the topic for today. I want to just go back and describe some aspects of second quantization. So in the end, we will not get just a single string, we get a gas of strings. It's kind of essential for non-perturbative theory, because in non-perturbative theory, there will be a coupling constant, which is typically not zero. So the strings are free to split and join, so it doesn't really make sense to talk about one of them. So I think I think I have four lectures, and my kind of aiming to perhaps end a little bit with this kind of non-commutative geometry, how it comes in. But I first want to start, say, from the beginning. So let's first talk about first quantization. And say, talk about the point particle that Dan was also talking about, supersymmetric point particle that Dan was talking about this morning. So suppose we have some space X, say, let's take it to be compact Riemannian manifold. Then what is first quantization? Well, it will actually associate to this a quantum mechanical system, which means a Hilbert space, which is for the superparticle, so this is the supersymmetric quantum mechanics, is roughly the ring of differential forms, the vector space of differential forms, some L2 completion of that. And then we have a Hamiltonian, which is minus the Laplacian. There's a supersymmetry operator Q, which is the exterior derivative. And there's a notion of a fermion number F, which is just the degree of the corresponding differential form. Now, basically all of the information of this supersymmetric quantum mechanical model is encoded in the partition function. So the partition function Z, say, of this space X, and it depends on two variables, Q and Y, is just to define the trace, and I always will kind of, this space H, of course, a graded vector space, and always kind of use the superstrace, which is with a minus 1 to the F inside here, and then we can compute Q to the H, Y, say, to the F. And just knowing this function will, of course, give you the spectrum of these operators H and F. Now, particularly important, whenever you have such a quantum mechanical system, are the supersymmetric ground states. So the supersymmetric ground states are the states which are, by definition, are annihilated by the supercharge Q and by its adjoint. And of course that means that such a state, so it sits in some time finite dimensional Hilbert space H0, and as you all know, this space H0 is then, of course, canonically the space of harmonic differential forms on X, which you can identify with the cohomology ring, say the Ramm cohomology ring. So to compute the dimension of the space of ground states, it's useful to remind you about the Witten index, which is by definition trace in H of minus 1 to the F, which, if you wish, is the superdimension of this infinite dimensional Hilbert space H, but of course is also the superdimension of the space of ground states, and which is just the Euler number of X. So computing Euler numbers is kind of the first step in understanding this quantization. And of course, there's the remark that this is the same thing as the partition function of X, but then evaluated with y equals to 1. So and if you choose y equals to 1, the Q dependence disappears and you get a finite number out. So this is all very well. So then we come to second quantization. I think it's kind of this wisecrack that first quantization is a mystery and second quantization is a functor. And actually that's true, because for free theories, second quantization is just taking symmetric products. But actually the rest of my lecture I will just basically discussing symmetric products. But there are some subtleties involved there which actually play a very important role in the way matrix theory works. And actually some of these subtleties we already saw this morning in Greg's lecture. So there's actually, so this is the first quantization, which I described over there. It's to space X, we just give this Hilbert space. And then second quantization usually proceeds by just taking the symmetric products of this Hilbert space, actually the sum over all possible symmetric products. Just don't want to describe one particle, want to describe a gas of particles. What I want to today is kind of see what happens if you kind of try to write something in slightly different order, and kind of first say second quantize the space, and take here, say, the symmetric products of X, say, the sum again. And I've kind of wonder what happens if you kind of now use our quantization procedure on this space and see what kind of Hilbert space we're getting over there. So somehow the question is this a commutative diagram? And of course, we need some kind of input, precisely how to deal with the quantizations of the symmetric products. Actually, you'll see that the way we want to do, the kind of natural way, is such that this is not a commutative diagram. So something slightly different appears. And that what appears is the thing which we kind of need in the end in matrix theory. So just some kind of notation. So first of all, when I write Sn of X, I mean this quotient of the nth Cartesian product by the symmetric group on n elements, of course. And then it's usually, there's some fancy notation. If you take, say, a vector space V, it could be a graded vector space. Then I will use the notation SP of V of a formal sum of all symmetric products, but graded by powers of P. So we take the sum P to the N of the nth symmetric product of V. Whenever you deal with the symmetric group, it's nice to have generating functions because the formulas become simpler. And then we can compute quite easily the dimension of such a vector space. But that's a formula we will see many, many times. Let's say the superdimension now of this formal sum is very simple. P to the minus the superdimension of V. And of course, if you take V to be an even space, this is the usual formula, binomial formulas for the dimensions of the symmetric or anti-symmetric products. Similarly, if you have X a manifold, I define SP of X to be this formal sum of its symmetric products. And somehow think of it as a vertex operator sometimes. You take all the symmetric powers of X. And that's actually a nice notation to study some of the formulas. So we always use all the symmetric powers, we fit them together into one symbol. Now, the thing I want to start with is the following. So, okay, we want to now kind of do quantum mechanics on this space. And so, as I said, the first step in doing quantum mechanics is kind of computing an Euler number, being just the quantum mechanical ground states. And so here we meet a very nice formula, which actually somehow played quite a crucial role in much of the developments in string theory the last couple of years in various places. So this is theorem, and actually it goes back to work by Goetze on Hilbert schemes of algebraic surfaces, but in the way I'm using it right now, it basically was first written down by Hirzebruch. Namely, the following formula. Suppose you want to compute the orbifold Euler number, and I will explain in a moment what it is, of this space, this symmetric product. Then there's the following formula. It's a product, an infinite product formula, where it's 1 over 1 minus p to the n, and here sits the Euler number of x. Now, physicists recognize the right-hand side as typically the trace of a Fock space, or the partition function of a two-dimensional quantum field theory. And there's actually something surprising here, because how do two dimensions come up? And it is very closely related to the fact that in the end, that we will see in matrix theory that we do this light cone quantization. But somehow, I want to explain how this formula appears. You'll see it fits very naturally from a string theory point of view. And then I'll probably start tomorrow by giving kind of the more physical interpretation of it. So let's first discuss what the orbifold Euler number is and how you compute it. So let me put the formula upstairs. Because it's of course important to realize that these symmetric spaces are singular spaces. So it's not quite completely clear how you should deal with their quantization. Of course, in the work of Goetze, he actually uses Hilbert schemes of algebraic surfaces, which are somehow desingularization. And then he proved the theorem for the real Euler number. But here we want to do it in the orbifold sense, because we want to have general space X, not necessarily an algebraic surface. So just a few remarks about Euler numbers of orbifolds. So suppose we have a general orbifold, say M mod G, where G is a finite group. Then you can compute the topological Euler number just as a space. And actually, that's a quite simple formula for that. It's just the invariant part of the usual cohomology. So one way to write it as the superdimension of the cohomology of M, but then take the G invariant piece. And you can, of course, write a more explicit formula by actually projecting on the G invariant piece by averaging over the group. So you take the sum of all G, the supertrace in the space H of M of G. And the kind of physics notation for this formula is 1 over G, sum over G, G box 1. But the 1 indicates that this is just the cohomology of M, and the G here indicates that you take the trace of the group element G as it acts on the cohomology. Now, the Lefschetz fixed point formula gives you a different representation of this formula as the sum of, so G acts on M, and can every group element can have a fixed point locus. And then you can just compute this also as the superdimension of the cohomology of the fixed point locus of G, again, summed over all elements of G. And say, again, the physics notation for this is 1 over G, sum of G. And now we use this notation, where the G indicates that you take the G fixed point, and the 1 indicates that you take the trace of 1. Now, this is the topological Euler number, but the orbifold Euler number, which very naturally appears from string theory, has a slightly different definition. So the orbifold Euler number of a quotient, it's kind of a generalization of this. Well, you can write it in many ways, but in this part you say, well, here you see the group coming from the G-invariant piece of the manifold M itself. In the orbifold definition, you take the contribution of all these fixed point sets. But remember that still on this fixed point set, there is a group action of the centralizer. And you take only the thing which is invariant under the action of the centralizer. So one way to write it down is that this is a sum over all conjugacy classes. This is my symbol for a conjugacy class of the topological Euler number of this fixed point locus M of G, and then you divide by the action of the centralizer. So this is my notation of the centralizer, all group elements, say, all H in G with the property that AG that commutes with the group element G. Centralizer. Now, one way to write this, of course, now in this physics notation is that you say, well, there's again a sum over all G, and now there is a double sum of commuting group elements, and you take this H box G, where G indicates, again, that we take the cohomology of MG, the fixed point locus of G, and then the sum over H implements the invariance on the C of G. Yeah, so this is my notation for, say, the supertrace in the space, say, the homology of the group element H. Yes. So this is typically what's called a twisted sector. We shall see how, in which sense it's twisted in string theory. But this, in the end, is the formula for the orbifold order. Why it is a natural formula, somehow, well, there are various ways to see this, but we will see in a moment why, from string theory, this is a very natural formula. So now we have a definition of what the Euler number is, the orbifold Euler number. So now we can start to compute for these symmetric spaces. So we take a very concrete example. We take for M just the nth Cartesian product, and for the group G we take the symmetric group. So we think now of our space X, and we take n points on it. So that's what kind of second quantization is all about. So points x1 to xn. So we have n particles moving on the space x, which means one particle moving on the space xn. And then there is an action of the group, just the statistics group, the symmetric group, which is say these particles are undistinguishable. So we should kind of identify the same configurations. They're not really marked points. So we just use these formulas upstairs now for this choice of M and G. So in order to do that, well, there are two things. So the first thing, which is easy, is to compute the topological Euler number. Because we have seen what it is just to take the homology of X to the M and take the thing which is invariant. So what it is just the symmetric, free symmetric algebra on the cohomology of X. So there's a very simple formula for this. So if you wish, this is just the superdimension of this SP of the homology of X. And so the formula I guess I just erased computes the superdimension as 1 minus P to the minus the Euler number. So I think this is a formula first due to MacDonald, quite old formula for the topological Euler number of these symmetric products. And so physicists recognize here the partition function of a harmonic oscillator. And it's kind of course, true. Harmonic oscillators, roughly a one-dimensional quantum field theory. So the fact that second quantization leads to this formula is kind of completely as expected. But here we use the notion of a topological Euler number. Now we want to see what happens if we use the orbifold Euler number. And so now we have to take into account not just, say, the contribution, if you wish, of the space M itself, but also for all these fixed points, loci. So we have to give a few specifics for the symmetric group. So let me remind you that the conjugacy classes of the symmetric group, as Greg already mentioned this morning, are labeled by partitions. So we have partitions n of small n, where here I mean that the group element is written in terms of elementary cycles of length 1, 2, etc. Sorry, capital N1, capital N2. F2S, say, capital NS. And of course, the sum of N, capital N, should be the total number of points we have. Now, what is now the fixed point locus? Well, it's clear if you have a group acting on here, say, if you have an elementary cycle acting on these points, so permuting them, that it's a fixed point if all these points coincide. So if you have a group element which consists of various products of cycles, then, and we take x to the n, and now look at the fixed point locus, we get just a product of, again, kind of Cartesian products, but now here to the power nn. So the points just coincide, sum over n. I'll produce this formula in a moment. Now, what is the centralizer when having such a configuration? So you should think now that there is a bunch of particles coming together. So here we have, say, and now we could have here, say, if you have an elementary cycle of length n, n points coming together. So what is the centralizer of such a configuration? Well, it's clearly a product again. So it's a product of the symmetric groups interchanging these cycles. Semi-direct is just the Zn group itself, which is just the cycle itself. So just a permutation. So we here we have n points which are cyclically permuted, and that symmetry group becomes a leaves that configuration invariant when these points are on top of each other. And since we can have n of these cycles of length n, this is the full centralizer group. So now it's easy to just compute what the quotient is. So we divide by Cg, and we see that this is, again, just a product of symmetric groups, because this Zn factor acts trivially now, and only this symmetric group will act on these things and symmetrizes these products. So we see that actually these extra contributions that come into the formula are, again, symmetric groups. Now, it's a simply straightforward calculation to compute the Euler number. So let me try to do that. So right now, it's kind of a little bit abstract mathematics, but we see in a moment that there's kind of a nice picture that goes along with it, which comes from string theory. So let's do the computation. So we want to compute this orbifold Euler number of SP of X. And what is it? Well, yeah, we use the formula that this is written as the sum over all the fixed point loci. So, and there's also, of course, the implicit in everything is always that we sum over all possible powers of the symmetric group, weighted by Pn. And so here we have then the sum over partitions, n of n, sum n, and n equals capital N. There's partitions of capital N. And then there's this product of symmetric spaces. So now we have just to compute the topological order number of these symmetric spaces. Now, this is easy, given the fact that here we have the formula for the Euler number, the topological Euler number. You notice immediately that if you write down in front the product over small n, then there's here just a sum over capital N, which now is p to the small n times capital N. So this thing here is now free. It's no longer a limitation that the partitions would be partition function of n. Could be general partition. And again, so here's the chi top now of S, N, X. And you see this thing here, we just computed over here. And so what you see is that this just is, if you wish, the product of N bigger than 0, the topological Euler number of S, P to the power N of X. So we get actually an infinite product of these topological Euler numbers, and that gives the formula that we want in the end, 1 minus p to the n minus chi of x. And again, the fact that we have indeed here this infinite product suggests that there's a two-dimensional quantum field theory behind. It has actually built up an extra dimension somehow. So somehow the Fourier expansion around that extra dimension are these powers n here. Of course, we want to at some point understand why. But here it's just an outcome of this. Actually, you can write it, you see something else, which of course we all know, that we can write this formula has actually nice, say, automorphic properties. We can write this as, say, p over delta of p to the power chi over 24. Well, delta is the discriminant, which is the 24th power of the eta function, which is a very nice modular form. So it's almost a modular form. It's actually a modular form of weight 12 for the modular group PSL2Z. If you write P as e to the 2 pi I tau, tau now being the modulus of an elliptic curve. So actually, somehow, out of that formula comes out an elliptic curve and a natural action of SL2Z. So also, at some point, we want to understand this. And I think the string perspective kind of will help us to understand this. But before we get this understanding, I first want to make it more complicated. But in the answer, we'll see how things fit in. By building things which have even symmetries on the bigger automorphic groups. One final remark is that if you take X to be K3, then chi is 24, which is a particularly nice example. And in the sense that then X is actually, this is the simplest case of a Calabi-Yau manifold. I mean, all Calabi-Yau spaces are very nice from the perspective of string theory. Not so much, perhaps, from the perspective of the point particle, but we will now move to string, so K3 would be basically the simplest, simply connected example. And we see a very nice modular form coming out. Okay, so this was... it's kind of a very refreshing way to look at second quantization, I feel. And it's particularly powerful because it's not limited to point particles. You can also use this to study second quantized strings, and that's what I now want to do. Oh, okay. Let me immediately say a very good point, actually. So there is a vector space, if you wish, because now one way to write this result is that this number is just the superdimension of, say, a Fock space, F of phi. So what is this Fock space? Well, F of p is, again, the p is just there to make the things, the gradation, kind of obvious. It's a sum over, well, one way to write it is this. It's a sum infinite product, sorry, an infinite tensor product now. Of what? Well, of this symmetric powers of a space which I call H0 n. Because but what is H0 n? Well, H0, we saw, was the space of ground states. It's the cohomology of X. So the question is, so we see actually we get infinite number of copies of this cohomology of X sitting there. And you can wonder, what is the way to identify now this nth copy? And so the claim is, but I can't really explain it well. I don't want to explain it at this point. We see it in a moment, how it comes up naturally. My claim is it's again the cohomology of X, but it's on a different degree. And the degree is actually shifted. So it's shifted by n minus 1 over d over 2, where d is the dimension of X. Here I just computed the Euler number. You could also kind of try to compute the Poincaré polynomial, the orbifold Poincaré polynomial. And then actually you recognize that these... How do you think about these spaces? It's actually the big diagonal where n points come together. So it's a copy of X, again, in the nth symmetric product. But somehow the cohomology of X is again there. There are infinite copies of them, but they're all shifted in degree. So I could also write down, if you wish, a generating function for the Euler, for the Poincaré polynomial. I actually will do it in a moment when we generalize to string theory. So I can say that there is a naturally associated this vector space. And in field theory, you would say, well, this, I recognize, what this is, it's a two-dimensional quantum field theory. So where my field is a map from the two torus, or from the cylinder, into this space, H of star of X. So it looks like we're dealing with a finite number of two-dimensional quantum fields, which are bosons or fermions, depending on the degree of the cohomology. And then you get this Fock space out. So I think tomorrow we'll actually see what the quantum field theory is, more or less, that leads to this answer. So it's more than just a number. It's at least a vector space. It's a graded vector space. Another question is, how do you think about the spectrum of the... If you really do quantum mechanics, what is the Hamiltonian on this symmetric product? And then, of course, it's your common problem because it's a singular space. But we'll see at the end of the talk today what is a natural ansatz for what would be the orbifold partition function of the quantum mechanical model. So now let's go from point particles to strings. So first to first quantized strings, which means that to a manifold X, and I really want to have a conformal field theory, so X is now no longer just an arbitrary compact Riemannian manifold. I really want to have it to be at the Calabi-Yau space. And say, let's call the complex dimension of X D. And actually, the formulas works a little bit better if d is even, but d odd also works. So what does first quantization now do? Well, it produces for us, in some way, a two-dimensional superconformal field theory, which actually for general manifold X is very little to say about. So we know there's a Hilbert space associated to it, which in some way we can think of as kind of the space of semi-infinite differential forms on the loop space of X. But I just put this in quotation marks, because it's not, there's no, very difficult to rigorously construct this model apart from perturbation theory in the volume of the manifold, or in 1 over the volume of the manifold. Anyhow, we know that we get this Hilbert space H, and there's a natural set of operators acting on, actually this two-dimensional superconformal algebra. It's a representation of that algebra, in the same way as the point particle was a representation of the simple supersymmetry algebra built out of Q and H. Well, actually, I will only use very little piece of this superconformal algebra. It's this kind of extension of the Virasoro algebra by two odd generators. So N equals 2 supersymmetric. Perhaps then at some point, are you planning to discuss this in? Okay, I will not write down the Lagrangian. You probably write Lagrangian of the sigma model. I mean, somebody will, I guess. So for the moment, actually, since I'm not actually going to use that, I just want to say that there are some operators naturally acting on the space. So first of all, there is the operator P, which is the momentum operator, and it has a very natural interpretation in terms of the loop space, because e to the I theta p will be just shifting the loop. So we have a loop x of sigma to x to sigma plus theta. And then there's also the Hamiltonian H, which is something like the Laplacian on that loop space. Now, these two operators are usually written in terms of the Virasoro algebra, say the left and the right moving Virasoro algebra generators. We write them in terms of operators L0 and L0 bar. So H is L0 plus L0 bar. P is L0 minus L0 bar. They're just commuting operators. And furthermore, there are naturally two fermion numbers, F left and F right. And you can think of them as the bidegrees in the sense of Hodge theory, of just, say, the Dolbeau cohomology of this loop space. Now, just as in the quantum mechanical model, we can kind of, in principle, kind of organize the spectrum of these operators. So let me say a few words about the spectrum of the operators. First of all, L0 and L0 bar are bounded. They turn out to be bounded by D over 8. And L0 minus L0 bar is integer, because that's obvious, it's just a rotation operator. And the fermion numbers, F left and F right, will be integers shifted by D over 2. And this all follows if you use the so-called Ramon boundary conditions for the fermions. So we not only have X of sigma, we have also its fermionic partner. And I take them, so some fermionic field psi, and I take that to be periodic. Both the left moving and the right fermions are periodic. So we have so-called Ramon-Ramon boundary conditions, and then these quantization rules for these operators hold. So whenever you have such a sigma model, you can again define a partition function, which is now the generalization of the partition function you have in the super quantum mechanics. So we have a partition function z of x, and it depends on more variables, because we have more operators. So it's a trace over the Hilbert space of minus 1 to the f. And then I define it as y to the f left, y bar to the f right, q to the l naught minus d over 8, q bar to the l naught bar minus d over 8. So it depends both now on, say, the holomorphic variable and the anti-holomorphic variable. Of course, you can write Q again as e to the 2 pi I tau. And then this is the partition function on the torus, or elliptic curve with modulus tau. And similarly, you can write Y as e to the 2 pi I z. And in z, you can, so here you see that there's an elliptic curve, e, say, And Z is now considered to be, given the boundary conditions of the fermion, so mathematically Z is a point on the Jacobian, if you wish, of the curve E. So we naturally expect this function to be a modular function in terms of the variable tau. Now, just as for the supersymmetric quantum mechanics, it makes sense to look at the ground states of this model. You can think of them here as certainly as independent variables. Yes. Say for a physical model, there will be complex conjugates. But in terms of this trace, you can of course consider them as independent variables. So particularly interesting are the ground states. So the so-called Ramon ground states, which are the states where L naught equals L naught bar equals D over 8. So the minimal value of the left and right moving Hamiltonian. And then the statement is that this space of ground states is again isomorphic to the harmonic differential form. So it's the same as for the point particle. So this is, say, but now of course we have, since we have a Kähler manifold, we can distinguish by degrees. And there's one formula which actually play a role that you want to say to which extent is the left and the right moving fermion number, the left and the right arc, do they correspond with these 2 degrees? And actually, since we work with Ramon boundary conditions, there's a slight shift. That is, the left moving fermion number is R minus D over 2, and the right moving fermion number is S, also minus D over 2. So there's this shift, which means that these fermion numbers are symmetric under F to minus F. So we kind of shift them by half the top degree. So the middle dimensional cohomology has, say, 0 F left F right. So this is all kind of standard ingredients about the partition function. Now, in general, it's very difficult to exactly compute this. Of course, and the same for the quantum mechanics. I mean, have to know the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, the Laplacian, and you certainly want to know the metric, for instance, explicitly. So only for very special values of the metric. And then, of course, it's not even enough to know the metric because you want to know the full quantum field theory. So only for very special signal models do we actually have explicit formulas, the so-called Gapner models, and for, say, simple Orbi faults. So we don't really want to... This is basically too complicated an object.
To what
Well, it's somehow defined in perturbation theory if you would have known the metric exactly. But yeah, well, that's so. Well, I'm not quite sure whether indeed it's 100% defined. For Orbi faults, it is. But for say a general, say K3 surface or something, you know it for special values of the moduli. At least we have a reasonable guess for how the partition function looks. I think. Well, just a flat space or a torus divided by finite group. Because there we have an explicit formula. But and also for certain values of the moduli of a Calabi-Yau, we have a good idea what the thing should be, but we don't know. I don't think we know it in all details. So one way to make a little bit more of a canonical object, although this is actually will not be very important in what I'm going to say, but just kind of say to stand on a little bit more mathematical firm grounds, we can go to a specialization where we put this variable I bar, and indeed here it's important that it's not the complex conjugate of Y, that we put Y bar to 1. Because in that case, we get so-called elliptic genus. And actually what I'm now going to say is actually something which was kind of written down in a paper we wrote with Greg Moore and Eric and Herman Vlinde a year and a half ago, and which is actually a good preparation material for matrix theory. So we have an elliptic genus, which now only depends on Q and Y. It becomes holomorphic in Q, because basically we have now the Witten index in the anti-holomorphic coordinates. So the Q bar disappears. And so it's just defined now as the trace of minus 1 to the F, Y to the F left, Q to the L naught minus B over 8. So this becomes a holomorphic object. And furthermore, it has a nice Fourier expansion in coefficients CML which are just the Fourier expansions of this holomorphic form, y to the l. And the coefficient CML now have a completely rigorous mathematical definition. So these are integers, which now are can be defined, and I'm not giving the full definition, as the index of the d-bar operator twisted by a certain vector bundle labeled by two integers, and the vector bundle is made out of various symmetric products and anti-symmetric products of the tangent bundle. So that's the theory of elliptic genera. But anyhow, this thing is now topological. It does no longer depend on the moduli of the manifold. So it's just a number again that you compute. And that helps a little bit. Just to say a few things about the properties of this object. So it's a genus, which technically means it's a ring homomorphism from the cobordism ring into the ring of so-called weak Jacobi forms. Jacobi forms are roughly modular forms which not only depend on tau, but also on this variable z. And a nice thing is that there are only a finite number of them in given degree. Actually, there are Jacobi forms, to be completely technically precise, of weight 0 and index d over 2. So you can have half-integer indices, so you have to be a little bit careful if you have alt-dimensional Calabi-Yau spaces. But in general, there's a map which maps the space x to this Euler number of this... Sorry? The complex cobordism ring, yes. And of course, we impose this condition of Calabi-Yau manifold, so the manifolds with vanishing first-term class, yes. And that actually means that this, there is a nice way to associate a modular form to any space X. And there are some interesting specializations that we will need in a moment. For instance, if we put the variable Q to 0 and keep Y, that means that we are basically projecting on the ground states of the signal model. So we again get the only contribution, say, from the harmonic forms on X. It's basically the reduction to the point particle, to the ground states of the ground states of the point particle. And here, so we get a sum. It's actually kind of the, again, somehow, what's technically called the chi-y genus. Anyhow, it's a sum over the Hodge numbers of X, shifted by this d minus 2, which is the kind of canonical thing to do in a sigma model. No, it's a cusp form, actually.
So what does V mean?
V means that you allow M equals 0 here. So it could have a constant coefficient. So this is one limit. Another limit is where you, of course, keep Q, but also now put Y equal to 1. And then you're computing again the Witten index of the model. So this is, again, the Euler number of X. But what I'm now going to say is valid just for arbitrary partition functions, not necessarily these elliptic genera. But if you want to think about these because they're better defined, then you're welcome to do so. So let's now go to second quantized strings. Now, second quantized strings, in this way of approaching the subject, would be doing strings on symmetric products. Now, one of the nice things is if you take a space X, which is a Calabi-Yau manifold, then, of course, all its symmetric powers are also Calabi-Yau spaces. They are singular, but somehow the singularities of orbifolds are kind of less dramatic in string theory. So we feel very confident of just computing the partition function on this space. So we do now want to do the sigma model on the symmetric product. Now, we have to think about orbifolds. So we're basically taking the step, again, of second quantization, say, on the level of geometry, say, classical geometry, before doing the first quantization. And we saw that for the point particle, this led to surprise, in the sense that we grew an extra dimension, and we'll see here the same thing happening. So a few remarks about if you have a general orbifold, M over G, then we know that if you have string theory, that you have several sectors, so-called twisted sectors, which is very natural from the classical geometry of the loop space, because loops on M mod G are not necessarily loops on M. that is, you could have a space, you can have the condition that if you shift the go around once in the loop, then you could have this condition where x of sigma sits in M, and of course G is an element in the group. And these twisted sectors are labeled by the conjugacy classes, because it naturally, you can see that you can naturally conjugate them. So for general, very general grounds, we know that the Hilbert space of any orbifold will be a finite sum over these sectors labeled by the conjugacy classes of thing which I note as H of G, where G indicates that we have, say, loops which are twisted by a group element G. And then, of course, the general condition in orbifolds is that you still have to take the invariant states under the piece of the group that still commutes, say, with the twisting. So you always have to take now the things which are invariant on the action of the centralizer. So this is a very general way in which the partition function of an orbifold looks like. So now let's try to implement this for the case where M, again, is this nth copy of X, and G is the symmetric group. And now there's a very nice picture emerging, because let's draw the space X, and now here we have, say, our N points. And I want to draw the loop space in terms of its graph, roughly. So here we have the coordinate sigma becomes from 0 to 2 pi. And now, of course, what can happen is that these points are identified up to an action of the symmetric group. So a typical configuration might be something like this. I'm drawing here the case where the group element consists of two cycles. One cycle of length 2 and one cycle of length 3. So these are, if you wish, permuted, and these are permuted cyclically. So the group element here is one cycle of length 2 and one cycle of length 3. Now if you just look at the picture, you see that actually here you're not drawing 5 strings, but you're drawing 2 strings. Actually, this string is, say, one string of length 2, because you see you have to go around twice to get a single string, while this is one string of length 3. So this is a very important ingredient in whatever I'm going to say next. So we see that there are these so-called long strings, or as they were baptized by Lenny Susskind, slinkies, which is this toy where you have this infinite world of coil that goes out of the stairs. And because in the end we'll see that we typically, in matrix theory, will be interested in when many, actually infinite number of these short strings will combine to form one string of, say, microscopic length. Right now I'm doing this for arbitrary n, but there's at some point we want to discuss the large n limit. But you see actually here that if you want to think of this twisted sector, it's much nicer to think in terms of these individual strings than instead of all these complicated fixed points, loci, etc. Indeed, what this tells us is that if we have a cycle, say, one cycle of length n, so we have coordinates xk, which, if you go around once, are, say, shifted by one, and this formula should be read cyclically, then it's very natural to combine them into one x of sigma, where sigma, say, now runs from 0 to 2 pi n. And of course, we can rescale this now by just dividing by n, and then we have, again, one copy of our original loop space. However, so I would almost say, well, we get just a copy of the loop space of x, but I somehow want to indicate with this index n that it appears slightly different. Because one thing which is clear is that these strings are, again, like ordinary loops. However, the circle action is slightly different, because you have to rotate n times to go back. So for instance, to make this kind of... And what we are really doing is that we're putting several copies of these strings next to each other, and we glue them together to make one long string. Now, one thing that you see is that since the string is much longer, that the spectrum of, say, the translation operator in terms of the original translation will be different, because you typically allow, you only have the condition that you have to come back after n times. So this means that the spectrum of the left and right moving Hamiltonians will be different.
So let me try to make this precise.
So I'm stating that in this twisted sector, which are all the loops which look like this, this looks like just multiple copies of the loop space of X, but with this slightly different action of, so we have this slightly different action of the S1, the circle action, and in, say, first quantization, this will give a copy of the original Hilbert space, but also with slightly different properties of the spectrum of the operators. And one obvious thing is that on this copy, the nth copy, L0, which I indicate with L0n, will be the usual action of L0, but now divided by n. And similarly, L0 bar will be the usual action of L0 bar divided by n. So it looks like it's the same space, only the actions are shifted or weighted slightly different. However, there's one point. Because this is the picture, indeed, of a twisted string. But in an orbifold, you not only have twisted sectors, you also have invariance under the action of the centralizer. So what is the centralizer of such, as a primitive string which is twisted by a cycle of length n? Well, the important part in the centralizer is now this factor Zn itself. In the point particle case, I should stress in a point particle, if you take the point particle limit of a signal model, the twisted sectors, of course, then the string should at once, it should satisfy the strictest boundary condition, but at the same time, it should be point-like, it should not depend on sigma, and the only way to get that is that actually the string will, the point particle will sit at the fixed point locus. There, so it means that in that picture, all these points are identified. Then the Zn action is doing nothing. Although the Zn action was kind of labeling this different sector, so also for the point particle, it didn't really play an important role. Here it does. So we see something very interesting in this project, in this picture, that in order to implement the Zn transformation, it's actually enough just to go sigma to sigma plus 2 pi. But this was, so this is implemented by the operator e to the I, say e 2 pi I p. So this is the generator of the Zn group, where p is L0, say, L0 bar, sorry, L0, L0 bar, but now n. This is, by definition, the translation operator, the difference between the left and the right moving Hamiltonian. So the fact that this should be 1 means that this, again, should be lying in the integers. Yeah, the first bar was erased, but not very good. So you see what we're doing. We are actually scaling, rescaling L0 with L0 bar, but then we're putting this condition, which means that in terms of the original L0, this now will be an n times z. So that means that we are having the same Hilbert space, but throwing away certain sectors. We take only the sectors where L0 with L0 bar is an n fold. So it's not true that this Hilbert space is isomorphic with H. So now we have a very concrete proposal of what the quantization of such a twisted sector looks like. So H of n is, say, isomorphic to all elements of, say, the subspace of H, where L0 minus L0 bar is, say, 0 modulo n. So this means that we can actually write down, now in one stroke, if you wish, what the Hilbert space is of this second quantized string theory. So given the fact that, suppose we know first quantization, so to the manifold X, we can associate the Hilbert space H. Then to this sum of symmetric products, we would associate, well, we have to sum over all these possible n's again. And we'll see in a moment how, but this is all that come out. And then we get the same as we got for the quantum mechanics. We get this symmetric powers, but now of H of n, where H of n is defined over here. Yes? With this n? Sorry, I don't understand the question. Yes. Oh, well, I actually mean, of course, this. That's the spectrum of L not mod I. The eigenvalue value of L not mod I not mod R. Yes. Sorry. So this is bad notation. Yes. So we know that this has an integer spectrum, and we pick out a piece which is 0 mod n. Let's throw away the other states. So this is a very well-defined space now. It's a subspace, and here we take this infinite symmetric product. Actually, so now, actually given, so this is now my, if you wish, my Fock space, F of P, which is the Fock space for the second quantized string theory. Now, I immediately gave the vector space. Let me now go back a little bit and just give the number. And actually, let me do it for this elliptic genus, because that's what we originally were doing. But I want to, I will actually come back to this definition of the second quantized string Hilbert space. Yeah, so let's now compute the orbifold elliptic genus of this symmetric powers. And, well, we actually, it follows, of course, precisely the same steps as we did previously. So, again, you write it as a sum over all n, p to the n. Then you write it as a sum over all partitions. And the product over all n. And then here you get something which is actually, if you wish, the order of the elliptic genus of this Hilbert space H of n qy. Now, what is this? So we use the fact that, say, for the single copy of the Hilbert space, this was the original elliptic genus. So this is just the elliptic genus of x. And this has this series component, this power expansion, q to the m, y to the l. Now, what is the elliptic genus of this string of length m? Well, remember that for elliptic genus, we put l not bar equal minus d over 8, at least, to 0. That means that the condition that l not minus l not bar is an n-fold just means that L not is an n-fold. At least it means that L not minus D over 8 is 0 modulo n. That means that in this summation over m, which are just the eigenvalues of that operator, we only take the n-fold piece. So now the formula looks slightly different here. We have summation over m and L, but then here you have C n times n L q to the m y to the L. Because we have a string that is n times as long. Sorry, the shift in this y? Oh, that's it's an important point. I'll come back to what this means in terms of the degrees of the differential form. Yeah, well, I'll come back to that. So I'm saying that there's no shift in y. But remember, the eigenvalues of y were not the degrees of the differential form. They're shifted by d over 2. So now you plug all this in this formula, and I'm not doing the combinatorics because it's completely, I just write down the final formula. It depends now on three variables. We have the P, which labels the power of the symmetric product, then Q, which is just really the Hamiltonian of the sigma model, or if you wish, P, or it is just the momentum along the circle, the rotation of the circle proof. And there's Y, which you can think of as the degree of the differential forms. And the end, the formula that you get is a product of all positive n and an arbitrary m and l, 1 minus pn qm yl. And here you get c n times m l. So this is the final formula. And you can think of this as a generalization of the formula we got in the point particle case. Now, there are various remarks I want to make about this formula. And that kind of finishes then this kind of mathematical opening, and then I will actually tomorrow move to a matrix theory. I want to make a few remarks about this formula. Well, the first remark, I guess, is about the degrees of the... You can read something out of this formula. So the first is the degrees of the differential form. So let's again look at the ground states. So we saw that we had actually also for the ground states, of course, L0 and minus equals L0 bar. And so the condition that it's an n-fold doesn't come in. So again, you expect that this is again in some way given by the cohomology of X. The same ground states, the ground states of these long strings are the same thing as the ground states of the short strings. However, there's something slightly different because this now is, you started off with a sigma model, which was the sigma model of n copies of X. But you looked at this configuration where these n strings formed one long string. So somehow you should think of this. Well, we had this kind of, it kind of sits inside the Hilbert space of the string on, of n copies of the string. Now, this is a space of dimension, of course, n times d. So I have this formula that I could identify the degree of the differential form with the fermion number. Now, the fermion number is here the same because this string is still the same string and the conformal field theory doesn't see the difference as far as the ground states are concerned. So I have, again, I can say that if I have a, write it upstairs. So now I can make this identification. I say if I have a ground state, I identify it with a differential form, say of degree R and S. So I have, say, psi equals RS of X. And I can think of this same thing as forming a ground state in this Hilbert space H of M, where I see this indeed inside the, as a subsector of the quantization of the sigma model on the n-symmetric product. But then I see that this thing has degrees, if I use this formula, of R minus I'm trying this to do this correctly. Yes. Well, I had this general formula, let's say F left was R minus D over 2, where D could be necessarily, could be, say, that it's just the dimension of the sigma model. So in this case, it's actually N times D. So I see that the degree of this differential form should be computed here with the, not D, but N times D. And so there's a difference, say, between the degree considered as of a first quantized string, or if you consider n of these quantized strings, and the shift is actually, well, now it's shifted with positive degree, d minus 1, sorry, n minus 1 over d over 2. Because we have to, so perhaps let me write it correctly. This is the formula now, and f left of n is the same as f left of 1, but now I write this as rn minus n times d over 2. So these are the formulas. So the fermion number is the same. Its interpretation, however, as the degree of a differential form gets changed. And this tells us that these, indeed, the degrees of the differential forms are shifted in this particular way. So that's the first remark. And this is actually something we kind of, as I at least told you, we also get in the point particle case. But this is a nice way to justify it. The second thing is that also for the point particle case, you could ask, what is the Hamiltonian now? And so that the Fock space was actually, you could think of as, let's a single particle give rise to a certain Hilbert space. What does the second quantized particle give? It gives this Fock space of infinite copies of the Hamiltonian, but actually the of the original Hilbert space. However, the Hamiltonian you see in these formulas should be rescaled by factor 1 over n. So I'll come back to that tomorrow. We'll see actually that this is precisely what you want if you want to interpret it, also the full partition function of the quantum mechanical point particle as the partition function of a second quantized field theory. Then actually these rescaling factors come in quite naturally. It's part of this so-called light cone quantization. But of course it's slightly more difficult to justify this just from doing, say, computing the spectrum of the Laplacian, because now we have the singular space. Finally, there's this issue of, say, automorphic properties. So we saw that for the point particle, we almost got this eta function out of it. So you could wonder what are the automorphic properties of that function that appears there. And actually, there's something here which is a generalization. So it turns out that this elliptic genus is almost an automorphic form for an extended group, actually the group SO23Z, which you can identify with a special subgroup of the symplectic group. And let me show you how it works for the simplest case. So the simplest case where this actually works, and where it works most beautiful, if you again choose as your manifold the simplest Calabi-Yau that we know, K3, on trivial Calabi-Yau. And then we can do the following thing. So the right object turns out to be... So we have to add some kind of modification to it in the same way in which we had to go from the partition function to the eta function by putting here some prefactor, and also in the summation include the contribution of n equals 0. So this object is slightly more complicated than the actual partition function. It turns out that this thing is very naturally identified with a rather famous automorphic form. So if you again write P as e to the 2 pi I sigma, Q as e to the 2 pi I tau, this was already a modular form to start with, a modular property to start with. We had a torus that we started with, which was a torus on which we put the sigma model. And this Y. And but this P variable we saw for the point particle turned out to be a modular form, modulus 2. And so here actually something similar happens, because this was already, there's an obvious SL2Z action on Q and Y. Well, that's what I was about to write down now. So you write the Siegel upper half space in terms of, say, sigma tau ZZ. And you can think of this, if you wish, but not necessarily, as the period matrix of a genus 2 surface. And then the claim is that this is an automorphic form for SP4 acting on this matrix over here. And actually what it is in this case, it's a famous automorphic form. It's the product of all the even theta functions squared. So it's a modular form of weight 10 for that group. And actually, it's like this, yeah. So it's the denominator of that formula, which is an automorphic form. So in that sense, you added to the mystery in the sense that you produced an object which had even bigger symmetries. And there's one kind of intuitive way to see of this. So it's just to end with this. If you wish, you can say the following. When we did first quantize, so we know that first quantized strings is, of course, 2D quantum field theory. So it's second quantized point particle. And one of the interesting, I think, mathematical, and one of the first, perhaps, mathematical insights that was given by this identification was that, indeed, if you have a two-dimensional quantum field theory and you compute it, say, on the cylinder, and somehow studying the loop space, you naturally get representations of infinite-dimensional Lie algebras, so like Kac-Moody algebras. And then you can compute these traces, say, so you have some representation V, and you compute some trace Q to the L naught. And taking the trace means that you work, actually, on the torus. So using the identification between the Hamiltonian Lagrangian formalism of quantum field theory explains why these characters has an SL2Z, because that's the natural symmetry group of a point particle moving on that torus. So now you could do something like, well, doing second quantized strings is what? Well, depends a little bit. Strings are not necessarily, of course, moving on a manifold. We typically move on a 10-dimensional space-time, and you can always write it, have it move the string on an interesting non-trivial space, and then factor with a simple one. So, for instance, we could do this also on the torus. So, say second quantized strings on T2 would be two-dimensional. What? Yeah, something like string field theory And actually, we'll see a little bit better what we mean by it tomorrow when we're doing matrix theory. And so we now want to do a string, say, on the cylinder. Again, this leads to a certain, it certainly leads to a Hilbert space. Actually, I constructed for the free string this Hilbert space. It was this Fock space, built out of these strings of various length. So we again have some Fock space, and we can kind of compute, again, something like a spectrum. However, this space is now graded by more than one operator. Because there's the obvious action of, say, the momentum operator, which rotates the circle, but also the string can wind around. So roughly what you get is that there are two operators. There's something like the momentum operator, and there's another variable, P, times the winding operator. So you get something which naturally depends on two variables. But we know by the equivalence between the Hamiltonian and the Lagrangian formalism, that these are strings. This trace can be represented by the partition function of strings, now, so closed strings, moving on the two torus. But to note what is the symmetry of one string on the two torus, we can actually know that, because that's something we can see quite explicitly, and I think Greg already told something this morning, that the single string moving on the torus has a bit bigger symmetry group than just SL2Z, because this is actually has a group S022Z. So that's the natural automorphism group of a string moving on the two torus, and actually if you take into account that there is this extra U1, then actually we can extend the 2-2 to 2-3, which is this extra variable Y that appeared here. So you see that doing second quantized strings on the two torus leads to much bigger spaces. They actually, again, are representations of infinite dimensional algebras, but of course their characters are much bigger, and their characters are also automorphic forms for bigger symmetry groups. Now it turned out that indeed in this case, although I'm not quite precisely clear for me to which extent these algebras are really have been defined, but that the algebras that appear here are typically generalized Kac-Moody algebras. So it's an extension. Well, you could ask, is this function phi the denominator of an infinite dimensional algebra? And I think at least if Gritsenko and Nikulin defined a generalized Kac-Moody algebra, which whose denominator of the is given by this formula over here. So anyhow, there is a it's also the character of an infinite dimensional algebra. Of course, the algebra is much bigger because we somehow extended this to string theory. Now, of course, here we have very powerful approaches because we know these second quantized conformal field theories are we know various examples of them, not just free fields. Free fields lead to the eta function, but we can go to Wessel-Meno-Mittel models and get more interesting objects over here. So now, perhaps one way to kind of make a little bit a preliminary remark about what I'm going tomorrow is to ask, what is this thing over here? Is there somehow a formulation that kind of captures the second quantization at one stroke, instead of first doing first quantization and taking the symmetric product? And that's, I think, in some sense, what matrix theory is all about, to come out. Give something which is quite, can almost be considered as a string field theory, and kind of see what are the natural objects that come out here. But so, in some sense, I want to kind of offer this lecture just as kind of a preliminary to what I'm going to do, because it's kind of perhaps explained this action of the symmetric group in a good way. So I think I want to stop here for today.